Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. This is the show where we invite three smart people into the studio for a discussion about the week's news or a big idea. Today, it's a respite from politics, but a conversation nonetheless that I think is needed in the midst of so much conflict and coarseness. The question we're contemplating today, how do we extend the community of the table into our civic lives? The generosity and the joy, even the reconciliation that can happen when we gather around good food and meaningful discussion. So our three chefs are going to contemplate this, and I'd like to hear from you on Twitter. Is there an experience over a meal that you've shared with family or friends that changed your relationship somehow? Maybe it changed you too. When and where was it? It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Ann Kim is with us. She's owner of Pizzeria Lola and Hello Pizza. Welcome back. Really good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
Sammy Wadi is owner of World Street Kitchen and Milk Jam Creamery, which I hear is like the lines are so long you can't even get in there.
I can't even get in there.
You can't even get in there? Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
And Marcus Samuelson is owner of Red Rooster and author of the Red Rooster Cookbook. He taught a class on Monday night at Cooks of Crocus Hill. You can get more information about their classes on the website. And you can check out the new cookbook where? Like everywhere.
Everywhere. Across country. Or,
right.
You know, Amazon. But go to your local bookstore and really support that.
Oh, you are good.
I love that.
You are really good.
Yeah, because you meet some really good people like, you know, you can talk to and they recommend you other great bookstores.
Exactly. Welcome. Look. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Is this idea that I'm putting out here for our roundtable, this idea of the generosity of the table, the idea of community at the table, something kind of off, or do you think it's something that's real? I mean, is this a real thing, I guess?
I think it's very real. You know, when I think about Ethiopian food, where it's very much connected, you eat based on a spiritual compass, which you do in majority part of the world, actually, except America. Maybe we do it around Thanksgiving and Super Bowl or something like that.
What do you mean by a spiritual compass?
Well, it's your spirituality, your religion that really drives the table, right? But in Ethiopia, where you have Jews, Muslims, and Christians, the whole idea of eating on the injera bread, right? That's a staple. And then you have these stews, whether it's chickpea or whether it's collards or whether it's holy stews, and you eat with your hand. And if it's a big celebration, you eat meat as well. But the whole idea of fasting, so when you do eat meat, it becomes this bigger deal, right? And the fact that you now are breaking bread with people, literally with your hands, connects you. So if you've never had Ethiopian food, or I remember when I sort of had it and started to think about how different it was for me one of the most intimate way of eating, but it's also a significant way of eating. So I when I think about community and I think about great, delicious food, Ethiopian food is one of the first comes to mind to me.
And what comes to mind when I talk about the community of the table and extending that into our civic life?
Mm-hmm. For me, it's always been about eating with others, whether it's with your family or friends, or now that I own two going on three restaurants, inviting a community to come and share and, like Marcus said, break bread together or share a piece of pizza together. Growing up in Minnesota, I kind of had two cross cultures. So I was born in Korea, and our family immigrated to the United States when I was just a little girl, about 4 years old. And it was difficult because growing up Korean, it was always about sharing. Mm. The only thing that maybe you had that was your own was maybe a bowl of rice, but everything else. And in Korean cooking, it's all about banchan, which means small plates, and you share. And it's never about, here's my plate of food, here's my protein, here's my potato. It's all about this element of sharing and community. And in the United States, it's sort of sad to see that people are eating on the run. They never take time to sit down and really share and talk about things that matter. They're watching TV. They're alone in their cubicle. And to me, I would really love to get back to that idea of food is about not only sharing a meal together, but sharing ideas, you know, sharing time.
Yeah, where I come from, eating alone is a sin. You can't eat alone. It's a community event. It's something that, you know, you want to kind of just share with people that you get to know, and even people that you don't know. Like, the door is always open. There's people come in, family, friends, neighbors coming in, and there's always food on the table. It's pretty amazing that, you know, that's kind of the way that most of the world is. And then you come in here, and then, you know, things change. Everyone is on the run, and we don't have that.
What's interesting about what you're saying is we almost, and I have to say, I totally buy into this. We in the United States, I think too many of us, eating is something to be gotten through to fuel myself so I can get on to the next thing. Mm. And I'm in a weird way kind of proud of that. I mean, you know.
But it's all a value system, a value proposition, right?
Right.
And, you know, when we in the, you know, post-Second World War, when we started thinking about convenience and we choose convenience over really real deep. And first of all, we're a young country and we're a diverse country, which makes it even harder to set, okay, which tradition are we sticking by, right? If you're in Sweden, smorgasbord is the table Christmas, Easter, and for midsummer. So there is something to really look forward towards, right? For your herrings, your cheeses, and all of these things. So in a way, they eat based on a spiritual compass too. And the other difference in Sweden is all nature land is public land, which means that poor or rich, you have access to free lingon berries. You can fish anywhere you want. You can pick any mushrooms here you want. But here, a lot of land is private. So that actually then, the arteries where you can actually just walk around and pick up stuff,
right,
you can't really do here. So by our spirituality being blended and not connected to food, and then the access of, if you don't have money, it's very hard for you to get access to cheap but great food. You know, that sort of cuts off a lot of these logical common sense places for sharing and eating together.
Marcus, I feel like we should say why you're talking about Sweden, because you start out talking about Ethiopia. Just a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I love the fact that we all have sort of very mixed, confused backgrounds here. I love that. I mean, that's like, you know, would be...
Yours maybe the most mixed and confused?
I think we're equally confused on that. But anyway, yeah, I grew up in Sweden and... I was adopted from Ethiopia, so they're very different in food cultures. But this idea of my grandmother grew up very poor, but she ate well, and her traditions around dining was very, very important. You know, we'll talk about, I mean, your tradition, the way you explained that, has nothing to do with economy, but it was very much to do with, as a family, this is what we do, you know?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think, growing up, we were very poor. We immigrated here. My grandmother actually came with us because my parents were both working graveyard shifts. Mm-hmm. And so we needed somebody to take care of us and feed us. And my grandmother didn't understand food in America. She couldn't conceptualize it. She didn't understand it. She didn't like it. And so she made everything. Mm. So we preserved, we fermented, we had a garden, which was quite difficult growing up in Minnesota. Your season is pretty limited. She smuggled seeds in. I mean, we preserved everything from meats to vegetables. And growing up in a small suburban town in the late 70s, early 80s is a little difficult. You can't invite your friends over and they ask, what's that funk? And you're like, oh, grandma's just fermenting soybeans outside. And
your lunchbox must have been the best smell in the whole school.
You know, kimchi and, you know, just like soup sitting on the counter, like, oh, and there's more flavor if we don't refrigerate that. So it's a very confusing, you know, it was very confusing for me. And so growing up, I hated it. I was embarrassed. I didn't want to eat it. I wanted to eat what everyone else was eating, which was basically back then, you know, canned, preserved, fat-free, rolled up.
Right.
And so it really, for us, it was about it wasn't food as fuel. It was about nurturing. It was about loving. It was about caring. And as a, you know, stupid, you know, young kid growing up, you know, I didn't show that kind of respect. And funny enough, now that I'm in the restaurant world, people are now embracing that and trying to go back to that idea of global diversity and how we eat. And I think the United States is slowly moving in that direction, and I'd love to see it happen a little bit more.
Sammy?
I mean, look at what's been happening in the past 10 years in terms of what just types of restaurants have opened up in our city or Minneapolis, St. Paul alone. There's more communities that are coming in that are more proud of the food that they serve rather
than
every restaurant that opens up that is from somebody from a Middle Eastern background, like a Palestinian will say, oh, it's a Mediterranean restaurant and it'll be serving Palestinian food. But they're not proud of that fact. And now we're more proud of it. You know, there's more Korean restaurants, more Japanese chefs opening up you know, kind of ramen spots or things that they want to eat. And that's more exciting for me, you know, in terms of looking at food than, and kind of in a larger perspective rather than just where I grew up and what I grew up eating. Because we were talking about, you know, being confused. I was so confused when I moved here. I was 13 years old. I'd moved all over the world prior to landing here. My family's from Palestine. I was never able to go into Palestine. We lived in Kuwait. We lived in Jordan. We lived in Canada, but we don't really talk about Canada. But now maybe after this election, I will be talking about Canada more often.
But you were disconnected from your ancestral roots,
pretty much,
roots,
yeah, absolutely.
Right?
And my parents tried to preserve all that.
Wow.
So they wrote a cookbook while I was growing up. Mm. It was the Encyclopedia of Palestinian Cuisine.
Wow.
So here I am, you know, 7 years old, waking up every day, and my mom is making all these dishes, all these stews that take a long time. So, you know, she's up at 5 a.m. to make a stew that they're shooting at noon. You know, and so, like, so this is what I grew up in. And all of a sudden, I'm in a country that is not really my homeland. And then I have to move again because, you know, war and such. And then I finally moved to the United States, and I'm really confused because I don't know what I am exactly. And here I am. I'm going to school. I'm trying to assimilate and fit in, but I want hummus instead of pizza, you know?
Hey. Now you can get both.
But now I put hummus on my pizza, you know? And really, that changed the way that I thought about food. So before then, everything was kind of boxed in. Everything had to be that one thing.
Right.
So I would only eat Middle Eastern food or only eat American food. And then after cooking in restaurants and saying, you know, I don't really love this flavor. I want more flavor. I want more pungent spices. I want more aromatic spices. And this food that I'm cooking doesn't have that. And so that started to change the way that I actually cooked and the way that I started to eat. And so now it's just a mishmash of things that I love to eat, that I grew up eating, and things that people around me eat.
But it's also, I mean, menus and food, it's coding. It's all coding, and it's also window in. Think about how much, I mean, food really travels through massive population like China and India, or massive trading like, let's say, Japan, right? Or like massive immigration. But there's a couple of other ways, but I do think there's all coding. And even the term, I'm a meat and potato guy. What do you think that's coding?
Yeah, you're exactly right.
That's coding.
That says a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also coding for completely something else.
There's a lot of subtext there.
Well, exactly. And all these things that we're eating today, it's coding and it's identity and it's a window in for a culture that you may or may not know that much about. But what I, as we can also look at the East and say, America didn't do this, right? But we can also look at how beautiful it is because this is the only country in the world where you are in a city like Minnesota and you can have Hmong food in 1 second, you can have some food from Somalia in 1 second, you can have a Korean young person opening a pizza place, and it's all based on delicious and a value proposition. So I know that we will never be Italy where you each region is very much about their food.
Right.
But we can go to Italy and celebrate that. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, Italy will never be America. Mm-hmm. Well, you flip that because that pizza store would not happen.
Oh, no.
In
the Neapolitans.
Okay, this
would
is
have me
such
by
a good point that I've
such
never thought of.
You know, for me, it's about celebrating the diversity. And I don't want to mention his name, but when he has more time left, is in a couple of weeks, Mr. DT, he should go to our places, and just take
you want
take
Donald Trump to show
Nobody,
up at
no,
Red
no,
Rooster
he's not, no, he's
in
not
Harlem.
To my place, but you know he should go to that Hmong place, and just take a step back.
What would you serve? Now here's Marcus.
No, I wouldn't.
We have to change his mind, Marcus.
This is the
I think your fried chicken,
chicken would definitely change his mind. Marcus,
this
is the round table and the food of reconciliation. This is the true test for you. Donald Trump arrives with his family at Red Rooster in Harlem, and you feel the need to have some kind of reconciliation with him. You serve him what?
I would serve Ivanka and Barron, and he can chill in the car.
What would you serve them?
Well, they can have whatever they want, and I would have a, you know, we'll have somebody bring in some, bring out some really good chitlins and chicken liver and collards, lots of collards. Sit on that.
Yeah.
You know, celebrate that. But the chitlins, because all your history, all everything that you're afraid of is right in those chitlins. Everything.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. I thought it was going to be a little break from politics, and it mostly is.
But let's get back to pizza.
Somehow we slipped into it. It's a roundtable with three chefs. And through the frame of, can we extend the community of the table, the joy and the generosity of gathering around a table of good food, can we extend that into our civic life? Apparently not at Red Root. No, I'm our chefs are guests today for the roundtable. Marcus Samuelson, owner of Red Rooster and author of the new Red Rooster cookbook. Ann Kim, owner of Pizzeria Lola and Hello Pizza. And Sami Wadi, owner of World Street Kitchen and Milk Jam Creamery. If you and I'm asking you, as you listen to the roundtable this morning, is there an experience over a meal that you've shared with family and friends that changed your relationship somehow? You got up from the table and you're a little bit of a, you saw the world a little differently, different person. You can tweet me at @CarrieMPR. So Marcus, I've read what you've said about how you wanted Red Rooster to fit into Harlem, and that you didn't want it to be the restaurant that kind of was only where the influence was only going one way, where you were influencing the neighborhood and the community around you. You wanted to be really receptive to the community to bring that into the restaurant. I want to know how you did that.
Well, I moved there 7 years before I opened the restaurant. And every year I had the idea of opening a restaurant. But then I realized I don't know enough. I didn't feel like I knew enough about the community at large.
Really?
And I knew that if I'm going to open, there hopefully will be a lot of guests coming from the community, and hopefully some will not come from the community. But if with a restaurant such an ambassadorship for a place, I felt I needed to know more. You know, a lot of African American communities are cut off from the regular grid, from schooling, from public transportation, and from restaurant. That doesn't mean that it's not filled with great food. And I needed to understand what those food arteries were. Food after the church, food in the park, the entrepreneurs that set up, you know, a jerk shop one day in one place and another place somewhere else. So in order for a restaurant to be in and of the community, we needed to hire staff from the community. We need to have a price level that was affordable and engaging. I needed to learn more about how can we build a farmer's market. So it's also a contemporary piece to the proposition. So it took me 7 years, right, to really understand fully. And then I felt, you know, well, now we can open. And opening is just what it is. It's an opening. It doesn't mean it's a finished piece. It's a very humble endeavor. You're saying, hey, come and check us out. We're here for you. And then we have to start tweaking from there, right? And 5 years into it, I learned a lot. And being in and of the community and going back to the core word, what restaurant means. It means restaurant means to serve your community. And that's what I feel like our purpose is every day.
And that's my question to you, too. How is your community influencing what you're doing every day?
When we opened up Pizzeria Lola, it was literally something that we were walking our dog and we saw a For Lease sign just about a mile away from our home. And it was always a part of my vision. Wouldn't it be great to have a place to work that's within my community, within walking distance, and provide something where it was sort of a wasteland? There really wasn't a lot to choose from there. We're right next, sandwiched between a Holiday gas station where people would go pick up their frozen breakfast sandwich, you know, and their donuts, you know, and a dry cleaner. And so we felt like people here in this community do love to eat and they do love the idea of good food, but why isn't there anything here? And so for me, having not been in the restaurant industry before, I really wanted to focus on one thing and try to do that really well. And one thing that I really missed was pizza. And I thought, you know what? Pizza is something that is the ultimate community food. Pizza is the food for celebrations. It's like, you know, used as currency. I mean, we've all been in that place when we've asked friends to move and what do you offer them? Pizza right. and beer, right? I mean, it really is one of those things. And so for me, I wanted to provide a place where people could come and embrace something that that they felt like wasn't available to them. And to me, it wasn't like I was trying to cater to the community, because a lot of people said, how could you offer a pizza with kimchi on it or Korean barbecue? Nobody's ever going to eat that.
That sounds so delicious.
Oh, Marcus, afterwards, come on over. You know, no one is going to do that. And your price points, no.
Were people really saying that to you?
No,
like,
they really were.
This will not work.
I mean, nobody really knew who I was at the time. So it was really more people, experts in the industry that were sort of consulting on how you should go about it, how you should price your menu, how are you going to compete against the Papa John's and the Domino's when you can get $5 pizzas. And I just said, you know, I have a value proposition. I think this food is good. I know how many hands it took to touch this, to get to someone's plate. And I do believe that people are smarter than we give them credit for. And once they taste it and see the kind of environment I built for them in order to eat it, they're going to appreciate it and they're going to come back. And we'll celebrate our 6-year anniversary in a few weeks. And I think the it paid off.
Three
gamble was right.
Restaurants later, I think you've got something. Sammy, so how is the community in which you open these places influencing you as much as you're influencing it?
When I opened up Saffron, I was 23 years old. This is about 10 years ago. The neighborhood wasn't really where it is today. So that's in downtown Minneapolis off of 1st Avenue and 3rd Street. And back then, I mean, we used to have kind of a seedy part of town that was kind of not really a perfect place for a kind of upper class Middle Eastern influenced food. But I fell in love with the room. More so than the community,
really?
More so than anything else. The room to me felt like it's an escape away from Minneapolis. Like we can make this feel like you're somewhere else. So I fell in love with the room, and then the idea started to kind of evolve. I knew I wanted to cook Middle Eastern food. I didn't know what kind of Middle Eastern food I wanted to cook. And so, and again, like I was 23 years old, I barely knew how to, you know, kind of order a pizza online, you know, back then, you know. So it was kind of an interesting time to be in and kind of try to set your feet in the ground and trying to say this is my mark that I want to leave. So we started looking for a spot for World Street Kitchen, and that took years to really find something that fit the bill. In the meantime, food trucks became kind of a thing, and it became actually legal because they were illegal at the time. So they became legal, and I just jumped right at it, and I said, I want to be a part of this movement, this kind of a change. And that one is really about the community. The food truck is all about the community. So we're in a downtown district in Minneapolis, and so kind of had to really cater to those people, but the food that I wanted to eat. So that was, again, a learning challenge.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation among three chefs about the community of the table and how they develop it, how they think about it in their individual restaurants, and then how we extend that sense of community out into our civic life. Sami Wadi with us from World Street Kitchen, Marcus Samuelson with us from Red Rooster and other restaurants in New York City, and a new cookbook called The Red Rooster Cookbook, and Ann Kim with us from Pizzeria Lola and Hello Pizza. We're going to get a look at the latest news, and then we'll continue our conversation.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm Mike Moen. Heading into the final weekend before Election Day, Donald Trump is headlining events today in New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, while running mate Mike Pence is visiting Michigan, North Carolina, and Florida. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton is rallying voters in Pittsburgh and Detroit, and President Obama campaigns for her in North Carolina. Bill Clinton is headed to Colorado, and Vice President Joe Biden is due in Wisconsin. The final unemployment report before Election Day shows U.S. employers added 161,000 jobs in October, and the unemployment rate dipped to 4.9%. Average hourly pay took a big step higher last month, rising 10 cents an hour. It's nearly 3% higher than a year ago. And stocks are inching higher in early trading as traders take in the latest corporate earnings reports. The market is looking to break its longest losing streak since the 2008 financial crisis. Two American trainers were killed and a third was wounded today in an exchange of gunfire at the gates of an airbase in southern Jordan. That's according to military officials. It was not immediately clear what prompted the shooting. And commuter trains running into downtown Chicago have been packed this morning ahead of the victory parade for the World Series champion Chicago Cubs. The Chicago Transit Authority had said it was adding extra service and capacity to accommodate people attending the rally, but trains were already skipping stops this morning because they were packed with fans. 43 degrees under sunny skies in the Twin Cities. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 9:32.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.
Programming supported by The Singers and conductor Matthew Colleton, presenting What's Sweeter Music, featuring Britain's Ceremony of Carols and holiday favorites, December 4th, 10th, and 11th throughout the Twin Cities. SingersMCA.org.
Sitting down at a community table, sharing food with other people, is not only the greatest way to share ourselves with other folks, it's the greatest way that we can engage in mutual exchange of compassion. It's the greatest way that we can honor each other with dignity and respect, and it's the greatest way that I've ever found to share our culture with other people. I've never left a single meal liking somebody less than when I sat down with them.
It's Andrew Zimmern really verbalizing the essence of the Friday Roundtable today. We're taking a break from politics, and we're talking about extending the generosity and the joy of a great meal, a community table, into our civic lives. Marcus Samuelson with us this morning, Ann Kim and Sami Wadi. And I want to come back to what Sami, what Andrew said about this idea of compassion. I don't think when you ask people, what happened at that great meal with your wonderful family that you had, the first thing that comes to mind is, I developed a sense of, you know, compassion and understanding. And yet I think that happens without us even being aware of it. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, food is the only language that can be understood anywhere in the world.
Kind of transcends.
It transcends age, culture, language, sexual preference, everything. You know, we can sit down and eat anywhere in the world and understand what that person means. And if that food is cooked with heart, you really can, you can feel that. You can taste it in the food. I'm a firm believer in that, like cooking with soul.
And you've got to believe that too, given what you said about your grandmother's ethic around this.
Oh, absolutely. And to me, it's when I travel, I learn the most when I go to the markets, when I go to the restaurants. Mm-hmm. When I find out where people are eating, which food stalls are they going to, where is their bakery, versus the museums or, you know, the guided tours. I mean, that's what it's about. That's where people gather. It really is. I mean, I'll share our vision. We came up with a vision for our restaurants in the last year, and it's to create a portfolio of restaurants that energize communities and transform lives. And I know it kind of seems lofty and, my God, are you running for public office? But I really do believe
maybe
that.
Maybe you should.
I do, whether it's transforming the lives of our staff, which we put first before anybody else, and then our guests, and then the owners, which just happened to be me and my husband, but that it really is about taking care of our people and it's nourishing them. So for me, food is about love and nourishment. And when my grandmother took care of us and she fed us, that's all she had. You know, she, if we were sick, she would make us chuk, which is a kind of rice porridge. And that to her was love. That was medicine. You know, when we were sad or if our parents were frustrated and fighting, they would take us, she would take us to the corner and give us our favorite rice cakes to, you know, take our minds off of sadness or pain. And I get a little bit choked up because opening up a restaurant is kind of the same thing that we're trying to do, is to create an environment where people don't have to go out to eat. They have accessibility in this country to gourmet markets and fresh markets, and they could make whatever they wanted. People come to eat because there is a sense of community, that there's an environment where they look over and there are people who are saying, have a slice of this. This is awesome. And they're toasting and the music is great and the food is wonderful, but it's really about that sense of being together and somebody taking care of them, somebody remembering their name and remembering it the next time they come back. And to me, that's the most important thing. I like to be in neighborhoods and communities. For me, that's important because it feels like the neighborhood all of a sudden takes ownership of, they're proud. And then when they find that people are coming from outside of their neighborhood, outside from the city, from different countries, they take pride. Like, this is a part of who we are. So welcome. And that to me is one of the things I take great pride in.
You were saying earlier to Marcus that restaurants are you believe restaurants are what attract people into communities.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Hands down. Real estate values go up because of restaurants.
But it's a value proposition that we talked about before, right? And first of all, as restaurateurs, as chefs, we're still in the journey of creating a profession that is on the same level as other professions, lawyers and so on, right? But we only been a profession since the 70s, regardless of ethnicity, right? And so if any of us would go to the bank and ask for our first, to start, the bankers will laugh at us. Like, we don't fund restaurants. Why would we do that?
Yeah.
Now, you travel around the country and you see major stadiums that have banks on them. Well, you know, we the public saved the banks.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting
but
point.
If Samuel said, hey, Mr. Banker, can you save my business? Oh, no, we don't invest. So why would it be that a bank is a better proposition than a restaurant? A restaurant does many things. A, you can't outsource the jobs in those communities. The chances of the employees that work in Kim's and Sammy's restaurants, that they live within the community and care about the community and make sure that the front porch is clean and make sure the light is on so not funky stuff is happening, pretty high. When that bank closes, that community, 6 o'clock, is dead. So this value proposition that one business is better than another business. The other thing our business does is also, it puts the value of the real estate up, but it also puts a level of people that would never necessarily see, like in my community, people wouldn't come to my community if we wouldn't have a restaurant.
Right.
People don't need to go to the corner to my community to see another CVS.
You're saying there's people in New York City that would not come into Harlem.
Well, you look at African American community, you look at the South Side in Chicago. What would happen if we would have a Red Rooster in the South Side of Chicago? What would happen if there would be a Red Rooster or a pizza shop at Ferguson, right? So, they have a CVS, they have a bank that you can pull money up, so they got their chance. So this idea that one business is better than another business, it's appalling to me.
I'm really glad that you used the stadium example, because the argument for the public taxpayers contributing to a stadium is, well, the team is a community thing. You know, we come together to
root
for
the team. So is the restaurant. That's a team.
Exactly.
They come in every day. They put on their uniform and they go out there. It's the same exact thing. And
I wonder why we don't look at
every
it the
single
same.
Day.
No, but it's because professions were set out.
Yes.
Yeah. And art was the profession that the fact is, my grandmother was a maid that became a cook, right? And the cook, even by the time she retired, cook was not a profession.
It's something that you had to
do. So now we live in an era where we actually, cooking is a profession, just like being a doctor or being a journalist. Well, we need that so we can actually have the conversation at the same level. And that whole idea of now we're arriving, the restaurants are good, but good for what? For whose community? So this idea of, restaurants gives you a sense of local pride, gives you a sense of tangible job, and also gives people that maybe didn't go to college a direct in to actually make pizzas or make hummus or make chicken. So this is another way that we're solving very current, very real issues.
I agree 100%. I mean, it is. I mean, that's perfectly put, honestly. The community part of the restaurant, people forget that's kind of like the underlying power of what a restaurant is, right? It's not a place for you just to only celebrate. It is a business. At the end of the day, we pay our employees, we pay our suppliers. You know, we kind of contribute to the local economy. And then you want a place where people are proud to be, you know, and kind of get the chefs, the cooks, the dishwashers, the servers to think about it as more of a career rather than a pass through. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to do this until I get to, you know, my next.
Do you think most
step?
People, if you're not the owner,
that's a
chef,
stigma. That's the stigma.
Don't most people still believe that?
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said about valuing restaurants in a different way as a profession. I think for the longest time, restaurants were just something where, for a long time, people didn't go out to eat. It was something that you might do on a special occasion. And now I think people look at restaurants in a different light. It's where they celebrate. It's what something that some families go weekly, daily. And I do think that we're at a point where culturally, we have to embrace and value restaurants and the service that we provide, that it is a profession, that it does take a lot of money to produce good food.
As you're saying this, I'm thinking maybe the kind of value that you see in the culture today. I mean, Marcus is a celebrity chef. Mm-hmm. He's on television. He's held up as, you know, we have this kind of food celebrity and food porn and some places. I sense that isn't the kind of value
that
you're talking about.
I think, you know, that helps bring interest to the profession, but that is not the reality, you know, and what Marcus does is pretty amazing, but that's like 1% of the general population. It's like kids that want to play football. Your 1% is going to make it to the NFL. The rest of you, you know, you go
to
college.
Be making hummus.
Yeah, get an education, but I really do feel that I've had a lot of professions in my lifetime, and I've never been in a profession in the restaurant industry where the people in the industry are so incredibly generous, not only of their time, but of food. And do you know how many times we get asked to participate in charity events or give gift certificates? And we're the first ones to do it.
Yep.
And we make... in general, restaurants have a very slim profit margin. You see restaurants failing within the first year. And Mark is saying about not being able to get a loan. It's hard because people think food is cheap. Mm-hmm. People think, you know, it should be, you know, you can get a 99-cent hamburger. That's what all food should be. But I know the kind of wages I pay my staff and the benefits I give them so I can make it a profession. So my staff can say, I'm proud to work here. Yeah. I can buy a house. I can have work-life balance. But that, you know, you don't just pull money off of trees. It comes from somewhere. And so if we're going to use great products, if we're going to use things that meats and vegetables that are raised with care and with humanity – you have to spend the money. And you have to price it at a place where people value that and understand that. And I think people are appreciating that more and more. And the more that people like Samé and Marcus do that, the culture is going to change.
But here's the thing that I was wondering about you, Marcus, since you are in that kind of echelon of celebrity chefs, do you feel ambivalent about that in some ways? I know it brings people into your restaurant and it sells cookbooks, but the other...
First of all, I mean, the term for me, I don't even think about, I'm very connected to the, you know, I came to this country with $300 and I am, you know, a nightmare for a lot of people. I'm black. I'm a black man. I'm an immigrant. And I think about how can I be in and of the community? I have 175 employees at Red Rooster and 70 musicians that work there. We have 40 employees at our other restaurant, Street Bird, and our office. We have about 300 employees in mm-hmm. Harlem. Now, we keep the lights on with that, with pride. And that has also sparked 25 other restaurants to open within the community. So there means about, you know, 1,500 people are working in the hospitality industry that didn't have those jobs over the last 5 years ago. We serve about 10,000 people a week, right? That's a lot of traffic that comes into the community, and that provides a lot of, we do cooking classes for free. So I don't want to list what we do for free, but, you know, just it's restaurants, what they do as extra and the charities they're involved with and the community profile that they raise. For me, celebrity has have nothing, nothing, not my, well, I was a cook when it wasn't the coolest thing to be. And when this little thing might go by, I'm still going to be cooking. But what I will not change, will I work as hard as I can so my community will improve? Because I do believe in one fundamental thing. Good food is a civil right. And if I can do anything to help that, I will do that. And if it takes me being on TV to provide those jobs and raise that flag, because we talk about Palestine, we talk about Ethiopia, and we talk about Korea. Poor people in those countries still have access to great food. And they do not have to fight McDonald's and trans fat and all of those different things on top of being poor. Poor people in this country, it's very hard to say you're going to eat well when there's a dollar menu as a mm-hmm. family proposition. So there is a completely, and we're, this is not, we're also going to be under the generation that had the solutions to this, but didn't fix it. Mm. We've done great with civil rights. We've done great with, we're doing good with women's rights, and we're doing better with gay rights. This is happening under our watch. Now, wouldn't we all as intelligent, forget Republican, Democrat, just as people, wouldn't we want to have narrow this gap?
There are more chef restaurateur owners now who actually can take control of what they're doing, which I think is amazing. All three of us are owners, mm-hmm. we're chefs, mm-hmm. and we control our destinies. And so for me, there's a level of empowerment there, whereas back, you know, 20 years ago, it was mostly big corporate change.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you had investors and people with stock options, and it was really about making money versus about really what is the vision? What's the integrity behind this? What is your point of view? What are you trying to do other than just sell a bunch of burgers for 99 cents? That for me, I think the idea of celebrity is what you do with that. Mm-hmm. You know, what is your platform? And it's about, this is great food. This is how we can eat, and this is how we can value it. And that, to me, is, I think, what Marcus is doing, and what I hope more, I guess, quote unquote, celebrity spokespeople chefs can do.
But you know who the true celebrity is? The dishwashers.
Yeah.
Those are the celebrities in
absolutely.
Our world.
And you know how hard it is to find them? Yeah.
Really?
Amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they're the backbone.
If they don't show up to work, guess who's doing it?
Right.
Samé.
Yep.
The celebrity.
Yeah. The celebrities. Right. Yep.
Okay. I have a chef's challenge for you. And Marcus actually kind of touched on this a little bit earlier in the roundtable. I want to give you each a scenario. On the night before Election Day, so this is next Monday, Marcus is already shaking his head. You've asked four of your own closest friends to join you for a meal in your restaurant. Okay, Two of these friends believe strongly in the Republican candidate for president. Two are committed Democrats. There is going to be political talk at this table, but you are hoping for congenial kind of talk that nobody jumps up and leaves the table of. Your challenge is to put a dish at the center of the table that will inspire empathy, compassion, and understanding. Sammy, what is that dish?
I have the perfect thing.
You do?
It works at home all the time. So when I wouldn't be cooking this. My mom would be cooking this.
Okay.
Okay, it's the meal that shuts everyone up.
Really?
Yep. I mean, and coming from a Middle Eastern background, like politics is, you know, what we talk about
of
at
course.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and in between.
Right.
You know, it's politics is everything. It's a series of dishes, really. So there'd be some eggplant dip with pomegranates and a little bit of pomegranate seeds on top and pomegranate molasses.
I'm sold already.
Some chopped salad, you know, dressed with sumac and lemon, a lot of acidity. And then next to it, some warm bread, maybe some hummus and tabbouleh, right? And then for the main attraction, it'd be a giant plate of rice that is perfumed with cinnamon and a little bit of cardamom. And then the star of the show is the whole roasted lamb.
Wow.
You with me? So she's going to marinate it in a lot of dark spices, clove, cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice.
Yeah.
And then a little bit of yogurt and lemon juice for a little bit of acidity. And then you just kind of...
Why is this the meal that shuts everybody up?
I mean, you just...
Because it's so consuming.
You walk in and then there's a whole lamb on the table and you're like, well, I better shut up and just get to it. There's going to be a lot of eating here. And this was a celebration meal. This is what we did to celebrate during holidays for us. But you would walk in and the aroma is just so intoxicating that you just go directly to the kitchen. You don't even want to say hello to people. And then you'll start hugging people after, you know, you got lamb fat all over your fingers. And that's really what it's all about.
I'll see you Monday night
before
the election. Anne, what would this, two friends who are Republicans, two friends who are Democrats, the eve of Election Day, and you want some... You want people to rise from that table feeling more understanding and more compassion for one another. What's the dish?
You know, I was going to say pizza, but then I thought about it for a while. And pizza's, you know, the pizza's pretty political. You know, you got people from all sides. Chicago, you got your deep dish.
Don't
New
try
Yorkers.
To serve me deep dish.
Yeah, you got your St. Louis style, your Detroit style.
You got the Koreans now?
You got the Koreans in the game. You know, what's going on? I think it's interesting that Samai brings up his mom. And for me, food is always about my mom. You know, it's about that connection. Because that was my first introduction to food, was watching her cook, watching her preserve, watching her face light up when, you know, people would show up unexpectedly. And she would initially freak out because she thought, there's nothing, but there's always something. Because in the Korean household, as long as you have rice in the rice pot and kimchi, you got a meal. And there was always like several varieties of kimchi. And she would bring it out and make a plate. And she'd watch them intently. And their face would light up. And they'd say, mashita, which means delicious. And the joy that you saw, the great pride. And to me, that would just calm everybody.
So that's the meal.
Oh yeah,
it would be
the rice and things that to me growing up just seem like it's just everyday food.
Right.
But now that I'm older and I understand the process and have asked her for recipes, the amount of time it took to prepare any one of these dishes was incredible. And there's that sense of that's why we Koreans preserve and ferment, so you can extend the length and so that you can have it throughout the winter season and always have that sense of plenty. Was rice and a great stew. What I think of is like yukgaejang, which is a spicy beef broth, chili-infused soup, which I think about now because it's getting colder, and then all the various different sides and fermented vegetables and a fish. For my family, it was always people always think of Korean food as Korean barbecue. That was sort of a special occasion thing. But growing up, it was about stews and the vegetables and the pickles and fish. And my sister and I used to fight over who got the eyeball. And my parents said, that's always for the elder, for the respected one, you know. And someone was always crying at the table. But to me, it's always about the sense of home and connecting it back to my mother, which always brings me a sense of peace. And when she, like Same said, when she puts food on the table and gathers everyone together, there's not much arguing going on.
All right. So Marcus, chef's challenge.
Yeah.
What is it?
No, I can see it. I would set up a smorgasbord because out of my narrative. And I wouldn't do it in my restaurant, actually. Well, we would do it on 111th Street and Lenox Avenue.
Really?
Because that's the north side of Central Park. And I actually wouldn't ask my two Democrat friends to come. I would ask the Republican to double down and bring four. You all get invited. And I would have a big, big old gospel choir in the background, and a little bit of jazz and a little bit of Latin music, you know, go in and out, because that's what we provide in the restaurant. And you will notice that all these people, they have funky names and they're happy and they come from different places. And you really see America. You really see the journey of the migration from bebop to hip hop, spoken words.
Right.
And then I would end up with gospel.
So the music sets the atmosphere.
Absolutely, because it's America's history. And it's
right.
A diverse American history. And I would probably start that smorgasbord with some really good Swedish herring. Mm. And cheese. And then I would have a couple of Ethiopian stews in there. I would have a big pernil pork roast that is Puerto Rican based. And then I would have greasy, big old, really good collards that are cooked with a little bit of chicken wings and bones. I would have some fried chicken. And we're talking about the next days and the choices that we have in front of us. I would like the service to be 5 middle-aged men. They were judged. They're known as Central Park Five.
They were accused of rape.
Accused of rape.
Right.
That Donald Trump took ads out in the paper and said, hey, we should now put in the death penalty in New York City. And he prejudged these young gentlemen, and they were innocent, and they were got tried as adults. And that type of racial tension and evoking and prejudging young black men and messing their lives up forever. 20 years later, they can never get those years back. And here I was on the eve of this. And the person that we seriously consider to lead this country that has been super committed to one thing, to spew on everyone, to be a racist, to jump women, and he's seriously still on the ballot to be the president for our country.
I guess I
now,
put the politics
that,
back into
eat,
this,
eat
didn't
that
I? And boy, I got it.
Eat that smorgasbord and enjoy that. And have the big old lady from the church beg her for forgiveness. She might give it to you.
I have to ask you about one thing. I noticed that when you were describing, I said, what if the Trumps had shown up at your restaurant at Red Rooster? Collard greens appeared on that menu and on the smorgasbord menu, both of them. Why?
Being African, collard stems from Africa. It's food of came over here. And also having a serious tradition of blackness, which is something that obviously I don't even want to talk about him anymore. I can't even speak about it.
But the collard green, tell me why.
Well, I think I would refer back to the Central Park Five. It's all in there. I can't actually talk about it. It's too big for me to talk about because it's so, like, I'm a person that moved to America because of diversity, right? I grew up in the cushiest country in the world. I'm not a refugee. I'm an immigrant. I didn't escape any political challenges. I came here because I bet on diversity. To sit here and talk about, as far as we come, to really, seriously have a person that has done nothing else but for 40 years been committed to hate, be the leader of our country. It's beyond me. It's like I shake when I think about it.
I thank you all for a good roundtable.
Thank you for having
us.
And a surprising discussion.